How significant a threat has the crippling of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan more than 2 years ago posed to that country and the world? Are there other Fukushimas waiting like ticking time bombs to devastate our communities? How does the nuclear threat compare with the more widespread concerns about human-generated climate change? How close has humanity come to nuclear war since the end of the Cold War? And is nuclear Armageddon a real prospect as tensions heat up in the Middle East? We will hear perspectives from one of the world's most outspoken anti-nuclear activists, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and from author and global research editor Michelle Chostovsky on the current crisis and how it may be remedied. On today's program, the new nuclear danger, Fukushima and beyond. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 20th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. It can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. As whistleblower Sibel Edmonds wrote this week, the inaction and apathy of people is our greatest enemy. Quote, apathy is a must ingredient for any police state, authoritarian regime, dictatorship, for abuses of power, for corruption, national atrocities, genocide. Unquote. Carl Gibson, founder of U.S. Uncut, recently spoke to Dennis Traynor Jr. about the uprising in Iceland as a model for a mass movement in the U.S. Though it seems we are up against a powerful opponent, we have the information and tools we need to create the society in which we want to live. Sam Smith reminds us that, quote, the key to both a better future and our own continuous faith in one is the constant, conscious exercise of choice, even in the face of absurdity, uncertainty, and daunting odds, unquote. He tells us that change starts with action, that each of us has a way to contribute, and that when, quote, we will have thrown every inch and ounce of our being into what we are meant to be doing, which is to decide what we are meant to be doing. That's from Protest and Resistance Against America's Police State, What's Your Breaking Point to Take Action? By Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers, posted June 17th, originally published in popularresistance.org. The 2008 shock was certainly violent, but the reactions of the system, countries, and central banks with their bailouts on an unprecedented scale managed to hide the worst consequences, downgrading of the West in general and the United States in particular, a forced cleanup of the economy, a heavy fall from an artificial standard of living, mass unemployment, the beginning of social unrest, have been able to be partly neglected in favor of recovery hopes kept alive by irresponsible policies diverting liquidity to the banking systems and stock exchanges. Sadly, whilst the world drugged itself, global issues weren't addressed. 5 lost years, the building is even less strong than before the crisis. The U.S. solution, orchestrated by the Fed, that everyone else left it to manage to take the time to dress their own wounds, has been to put out with gasoline the fire which they themselves lit. It's not surprising, then, that it is still the U.S., pillar of the world before, refusing to fall in line with their faithful Japanese and British floats, which is once again igniting the world situation. And this time, we shouldn't rely on bankrupt countries to save the situation. They are on their knees following the first shock in 2008. Therefore, it's actually a second world crisis which is looming, once again caused by the United States. That's from Global Systemic Economic Crisis, devastating financial explosion and social outburst on a worldwide scale from Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin posted June 17th. Russia and China, having learned their lesson, are protesting Washington's assault on Syria that Washington pretends is a civil war. If Syria falls, Russia and China know that Iran is next. Both Russian and Chinese governments know that after Iran falls, they are next. There is no other explanation for Washington surrounding Russia with missile bases and surrounding China with naval and air bases. Washington's crazed, demented drive for world hegemony is bringing unsuspecting Americans up against two countries with hydrogen bombs whose combined population is 5 times the U.S. population. That article is from Fake WMD Intelligence and Orwellian Doublespeak, Washington is Insane, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted June 17th, originally published at paulcraigroberts.org. Indirectly, Russia is being blamed for the Boston Marathon bombings. The Tsarnaev brothers, who are half-ethnic Chechen and half-ethnic Avar, are being identified with Russia, even though they spent a great deal of their lives outside the Russian Federation and are U.S. citizens. Jokar was born in Kyrgyzstan, where he spent his childhood years. Russia has been presented as a breeding ground for terrorists and militants, while Iran has been portrayed as a new base for Al-Qaeda. The murder of Russia's Muslim leaders in the North Caucasus coincides with notions that the United States is planning to destabilize Russia's North Caucasus. After Syria, in fact, there are strong fears that Russia's North Caucasus, along with Lebanon and Iraq, will be the next targets of anti-government militants in Syria. That's from the article, Are the Boston Marathon Bombings Tied to a New American Campaign in the Caucasus? By Mahdi Darius Nazimroya, posted June 17th, originally posted at the Strategic Culture Foundation website. Several African states have rejected statements made by Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, which have challenged the right of Ethiopia to utilize water from the Blue Nile in order to construct a hydroelectric dam. Ethiopia says that the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam project is necessary to not only provide power for the several contiguous states, but to also reverse a British colonial-era law that deliberately divides Egypt from other states through the allocation of water from the Nile. Egyptian leaders under the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government has responded to the Ethiopian plan with threats of military action, including sabotage. President Morsi said of the situation that, quote, we do not want a war, but we are keeping all options open, unquote. The dispute between the two states is rooted in the legacy of British imperialism in North, Northeast, and Central Africa during the 20th century. That's from the article, Water and the Geopolitics of the Nile Valley, Egypt Confronts Ethiopia, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted June 18th and originally published in Pan-African Newswire. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. My guest is Helen Caldicott. She is the author of 9 books, including Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Save the Earth, and The New Nuclear Danger, George W. Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. She is an Australian physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate, and shortly after the Three Mile Island incident in 1981, she left her medical practice to concentrate her attention on the nuclear arms race. She was the founding president from 1978 to 1983 of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which recruited 23,000 doctors committed to educating the public and their colleagues on the dangers of nuclear energy. She is among the world's most outspoken anti-nuclear advocates, with a very busy lecturing schedule. So I'm very pleased to have her with us to speak about the clear and present threats currently with regard to nuclear energy and nuclear power. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Caldicott.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, now, I know that since probably the most clear and present threat currently is the collapse and crippling of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant in Japan, which was hit by that earthquake and typhoon 2.25 years ago now. It's not an issue that's getting making headlines on an ongoing basis. I would presume that you would would agree that it's not getting as nearly as much attention as it should. Could you maybe help us understand a little bit more just how significant that that incident has been, and how high the stakes are for humanity?
It's the worst industrial accident in history. It's more severe than Chernobyl in many ways. It released two to three times more noble gases, which are argon, xenon, and krypton, than did Chernobyl. Much of the radiation, or 80%, went across the Pacific because the winds were blowing from west to east at that time, but the rest went over Japan because the winds changed. There were three meltdowns within about 3 or 4 days, which is absolutely unheard of. The Japanese government didn't tell the Japanese people for 2 or 3 months that there'd been three meltdowns. There were 4 major hydrogen explosions, with maybe a kind of nuclear explosion as well. Huge amounts of radiation were released, but not just that, they're still being released. The reactors are severely damaged. There seems really pragmatically no way they can get in to get the spent fuel out, or the radioactive fuel, because it's what's called corium. 100 tons of uranium and fission products have melted in each reactor into sort of a larval mass and melted their way through the reactor container vessel onto the floor of the containment. And no one can get near it because it's so intensely radioactive. Underground water is pouring into the reactors, as well as they having to use seawater continuously to cool the reactors, and the water that then comes out of those three reactors is intensely radioactive. TEPCO, which is Tokyo Electric Power Company, would like to expel that water into the Pacific Ocean, but that's not on because that's where the Japanese catch lots of their fish. The fish are radioactive anyway for several hundred kilometres from the reactor, many of the fish, but the fishermen are deadly opposed to any more water being released. Well, the fact is that they've got, I can't remember how many, hundreds of huge tanks holding the water, but they're running out of tank space. They're going to chop down a forest and build some more tanks. But eventually, there's no way around it. I think the water will be expelled into the Pacific for, who knows, decades or longer, meaning that large amounts of radiation will be entering the ocean, not that large amounts haven't already entered the ocean. The accident is still expelling radiation into the air. The food in much of the Fukushima prefecture is contaminated with radioactive elements. People are eating the food. And more than that, the building 4 has been severely damaged by the original earthquake. It's very fragile, and on the roof of building 4 is a huge cooling pool containing intensely radioactive fuel, over 100 tons. And that has to be continually cooled with water pumped into it. If there's another earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, it is predicted the building will collapse, down will come the cooling pool, the water will be leaked out, and the fuel itself will catch fire and releasing 10 times more cesium than was released at the Chernobyl reactor, which was a lot. That could mean the end of much of Japan, but more than that, will be a severe, severe threat to the Northern Hemisphere, They say they're going to take 2 years to fix Building 4. The Japanese will not allow any other people to come and help them, although it's a global catastrophe, potentially, and they're doing it on their own. The media is not talking about this at all. It's as if it's all over. It's not over, and will, I think, in our lives, never be over. And it's extraordinary to me that the media are not attending to the situation, and people are still going to Japan to ski and for holidays, not understanding the danger that much of the food is radioactive. And because you can't taste radiation, you don't know where the food's coming from and where it was harvested. So it's a public health catastrophe which will continue because the land is contaminated, much of it, for hundreds of years.
Well, you mentioned people visiting Japan being unaware of the danger. What about the people who are living in Japan? And I mean,
yes, what about
are they closer to ground zero, as it were? Do they have a different perspective, or are they also being taken in by media?
Well, the women know what's going on, and they're terribly upset. And many of them fled from the Fukushima prefecture just after the accident. It's caused breakups of marriage, etc., because the men can't necessarily leave their job and the men don't necessarily think there's a danger. I think there are 10 million people in very, very radioactive areas still. Some areas so radioactive that they are exclusion zones around Chernobyl, but they're allowing the Japanese people to live there. They're feeding Japanese children radioactive food on purpose. They're encouraging the Fukushima farmers to replant their rice and other such vegetables, and they are selling them in Tokyo. Parts of Tokyo, too, are extremely radioactive. Now, because cancer takes from 2 to 80 years to manifest itself after you've been exposed to radioactive elements, either externally, like X-rays, or internally by eating radioactive food and the radiation lodges in various organs, it's not apparent yet what's going to happen. We do know that there are a lot of infections in people after the accident, meaning their immune systems were probably depleted by radiation. We do know that many experience symptoms of acute radiation illness with their hair falling out and severe nausea and diarrhea, and I think a lot of bleeding noses. However, they've just surveyed 174,376 children under the age of 18 in the Fukushima prefecture and found that, I think the number is now 12, have been diagnosed with thyroid cancer, with I think 5 or more still, or 15, I can't remember the exact figures, still suspected of having cancer. Now, around Chernobyl, the children didn't develop cancer for 5 years, 4 to 5 years. This is only 2 years post-accident, indicating to me, as I'm a pediatrician, that these children received a very high dose of radioactive iodine and also cesium, which concentrates in the thyroid as well. And this prognosticates a very poor outcome for these children and others because they obviously received a very high dose, but not just of radioactive iodine and cesium, which go to the thyroid, but lots of other elements. And so they and everyone else are at risk of developing cancer over their lifetimes. And indeed, survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki are still developing cancers related to the atomic bomb explosions many, many years later.
Okay, you said something rather, what I found very shocking earlier is that people are deliberately feeding people radioactive food.
Including kindergarten children.
Is it a question of just not being aware that it's radioactive, or
I think they are aware, but the Japanese are excellent, and especially the government and officials, excellent at denying situations, and they are invested in the nuclear industry. Children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. They get cancer much more readily because their cells are actively dividing. And during that process of active cell division, that's when the genes can be damaged, causing mutations in genes that control the rate of cell division. So later, those cells or that cell can start multiplying in an unregulated fashion, and that's a cancer. Little girls are twice as sensitive as little boys. We don't know why. Women are more sensitive than men. Fetuses are thousands of times more sensitive than adults, yet the industry uses a standard white male 70 kilograms age 25 as their standard for what sort of dose people can receive. I held a conference in New York in March on the second anniversary of Fukushima called The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. And it was a two-day event with just the best scientists in the world talking about their latest data. And there was one scientist there, a physician called Dr. Wertelecki, who's been looking at children born in a village near Chernobyl where the people have lived for hundreds and hundreds of years and they eat the local berries and the mushrooms and the food there. And he's found a high incidence of severe congenital anomalies like high incidence of Siamese twins, conjoint twins, neural tube defects like spina bifida and abnormalities in the brain, very small brains, and lots of other abnormalities. And that's related to the fact that the women having the babies have a very high level of cesium in their bodies from eating radioactive food. And you see, cesium lasts for 300 years. And so it lands on the ground, gets concentrated in the food, the mushrooms, etc. And then it gets more concentrated in human bodies when people eat the radioactive food. And so you can see that the disaster, the radioactive disaster, just doesn't end suddenly. It goes on for years and, you know, hundreds of years. And I think that's what the media don't understand. So I held this conference to try and educate the media, but we didn't get much attention. You can download the conference if you go to HelenCaldicottFoundation.org, and the conference can be downloaded and you can listen to the whole thing. It's quite outstanding. It was opened by the Prime Minister of Japan, Naoto Kan, who was the Prime Minister at the time of the accident, who gave an absolutely stunning speech. So I would advise people who want to learn more about this to download that conference and listen to it.
Now, you also mentioned the whole issue of this goes beyond Japan, that there's like the whole northern hemisphere would be at risk with the collapse of Reactor 4, I think you said it was. Are we starting to see effects coming from as a result of that, like, impacting on North Americans?
Well, in the early days of the accident, the ambient levels of radiation in Seattle went 40,000 times above normal. Radioactive elements fell out with rain, bringing the elements down to Earth in many areas of America, some of them really nasty elements. It was very dilute, but, you know, if you eat some food with americium in it, just even a few atoms could later cause cancer. But you'll never know because you can't taste it. We really have the EPA is not testing your food or your water. They're not testing the fish caught in the Pacific, although they found that tuna caught off the coast of California contains cesium from Fukushima. The plume of radiation that's heading towards you across the Pacific will be reaching your shores shortly. And they should be testing the fish routinely, but they're not. There haven't been any decent medical studies yet, epidemiological studies, to look at health effects, and actually it's really too early in a way to see any health effects thus far. I'm not so worried about Americans, except if building four goes. Then I would be extremely worried. What you need to know is that the two air masses in the northern and southern hemisphere don't mix at the equator, so it will be the northern hemisphere that will be irradiated if that building should collapse. So it's a race against time.
And at the same time, that trying to fix that unit is nearly impossible. You can't get near it because of the intensity of the radiation.
No, that's not right. Building 4 is not so terribly radioactive, although the surrounding areas are. What they have to do is build another building around the dilapidated, fragile Building 4, strong enough to put a huge crane on top of the new building so that they can lift the radioactive fuel rods out of the cooling pool and transfer them to some sort of containers. And that's got to be an extremely strong building. And the Japanese are not asking anyone to help them build that building, and it's a matter of absolute urgency. The original crane they had on the top of Building 4 to move those fuel rods was totally disabled by the earthquake. So they say it'll be up to 2 years before that work is complete. And the whole global community should be there helping.
Well, in the worst case scenario, which would presumably be the way to get the attention of the world's situation, we suppose that all the cooling water just drains out, that nuclear material is exposed, you have a fire, right, that can't put out, and it's releasing all that radiation. What kinds of impacts are we going to see as a result of it? I mean, more cancers? No?
Not a fire. The seawater is used to keep the molten masses of uranium in those three reactors cool. And the water itself comes out, it's extruding from the reactors, and it's very, very radioactive. They've got filters that the French provided to filter out a lot of the radioactive elements, but then the filters are incredibly radioactive. What do they do with them? More and more radiation is going to enter the ocean. Many of the rivers in Japan are extremely radioactive, and the fish, the freshwater fish, tend to be very radioactive too. The Japanese live on fish, you know. We're going to see, my prediction is we're going to see a lot of cancers. Now, some people are predicting 60,000 more cancers in Japan. I would say more. A report was released by the New York Academy of Sciences called Chernobyl in 2009, and it comprised 5,000 papers that were translated from Russian into English. And it describes many diseases that have been caused by Chernobyl, including premature aging, sudden heart attacks, thyroid cancers of every sort, endocrine abnormalities, cataracts of the eye, and many other illnesses. And what they estimate is that over 1 million people have died as a result of Chernobyl. So that if you extrapolate back to Fukushima, it's hard because 80% of the radiation originally released went across the Pacific, but there was a huge amount released. It's hard to know how many cancers there will be, but suffice it to say, radiation is still being emitted from those reactors every day into the air and the water, and will continue for decades.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. What are some of the other nuclear dangers that you feel that we need to urgently address?
Well, you've got now 100 operating reactors in the United States. Four have been closed down recently, actually. What's happening is, because of Fukushima, and I predicted this, the nuclear industry is in terrible strife. Economically, it's in terrible trouble. Most of the reactors in your country are very old, reaching the end of their lifetime, which is about 40 years. They're falling apart. They're dangerous. Some are the same design as the GE Mark I reactors in Fukushima, including one at Pilgrim, which is at the entrance to Cape Cod, and including one in Vermont. So you are, and there's a huge amount of radioactive fuel stored on the roof of many of your reactors, like the one at Building 4 in Fukushima. You're just lucky that you haven't had any major accidents lately, but during Hurricane Sandy, I think there were about 14 reactors at risk along the east coast. A hurricane or a cyclone can take out the external power supply, which supplies the power for the cooling pumps, and each nuclear reactor needs 1 million gallons a minute to keep it cool from the sea or from the lake on which it's situated. And if you lose the external power supply, then you lose your cooling pumps. And that's what happened at Fukushima. They do have emergency diesel generators in the reactor building, but those diesel generators got flooded and destroyed by the tsunami in Fukushima. So they were without power. And that's why the reactors melted down, because there was no, they couldn't keep 1 million gallons of water circulating to keep the reactor cool. Similarly, in America, you know, you've had terrible power outages with a sort of cascading effect from the Midwest across to the East Coast. That was a few years ago. Also, the sea levels are rising. They're rising more rapidly on the East Coast of America than anywhere else in the world because of global warming. Storms are becoming more and more ferocious, as we know. Many of the reactors are at sea level on the East Coast, and storms can produce huge elevations of water, as we saw in Hurricane Sandy, which flooded much of New York. And so the control rooms and mechanisms to keep a reactor going could be damaged, and reactors could melt down. And with global warming, a lot of reactors are built on rivers, and the rivers are now drying up. In some cases in summer, that happened in France, the waters get so hot in the rivers it's not suitable for cooling the reactors, and they have to shut them down. So global warming is antithetical to the safe operation of nuclear power. From storms and hurricanes and water level rising in the sea, and water levels falling in rivers and the like. And then you've got radioactive waste, which must be isolated from the ecosphere for 1 million years, according to the EPA. Mm. And that waste will inevitably leak over decades and into water, and then be reconcentrated back in the food chain, in the milk and the meat and the breast milk and babies' bodies and human bodies. And so the nuclear waste we're producing to turn our lights on will, over time, inevitably induce epidemics of cancer, of leukemia, of genetic diseases, and of congenital deformities, virtually for the rest of time. And it's not only humans that have genes and are damaged by radiation, it's all species, plants and animals as well. So we're destroying the process of evolution by filling the environment up with radioactive waste. It's quite extraordinary, really.
Dr. Caldicott, speaking of waste, and there, you know, you seem to be very matter of fact when you say that that this waste will inevitably leak over the decades. But are you aware of any maybe close calls in recent years where there was, or you know, maybe actual spills that people should be concerned about?
Yeah, there's a place in West Valley, New York, where there's a private company, I can't remember which one it was, Bechtel or one of them, which was reprocessing spent reactor fuel. Now, what does that mean? You take very radioactive fuel rods out of a reactor. You chop them up by remote control. You melt them or dissolve them in concentrated nitric acid. And from that solution, you remove plutonium. Now, plutonium, terrific stuff, because that's what you make bombs with. You only need 5 to 10 pounds to make yourself an atomic bomb. The designs on the internet. Each reactor makes 500 pounds of plutonium a year. Plutonium lasts for 250,000 years, so you've always got it to make bombs. So they were extracting the plutonium, and also they want to put plutonium in new nuclear reactors, which is extraordinarily dangerous, but I won't go into that at the moment. Now, West Valley has a huge amount of very, very high level, very dangerous radioactive waste, which is leaking and contaminating the streams and the rivers there close by. When I was much younger, I went to Congress early in the 1980s, and I saw the congressman who represented the area of West Valley, and I'm only a medical doctor, and he said to me, well, what can we do with the radioactive waste? You tell us what to do. And nothing's really been done about it. And then I don't even know if there have been any epidemiological studies to look at the people who live nearby and to assess the incidence of cancer near there. But I will say that the Germans and French have done studies of children under the age of 5 living within 5 kilometres of reactors and found that these children have double the incidence of leukemia and a high incidence of solid cancers. So it's very dangerous to live near a nuclear power plant because they continuously release radiation into the air and water all the time.
I seem to recall a fairly intense dialogue between yourself and George Monbiot just shortly after the Fukushima disaster, effectively, you know, saying that, I mean, I guess his point was that the nuclear industry is a potential remedy against the use of carbon. And so I'm wondering how your thoughts about this whole idea of, that we have people who are so concerned, and legitimately so, I suppose, about the threats posed by climate change, and then nuclear sort of being like the extent to which it might mitigate against your real action on reducing the nuclear threat. Is that
okay? I commissioned a report about 5 years ago called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free by a brilliant physicist called Arjun Makajani, and you can download it from the net. Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. And it shows that all electricity in America can be supplied by renewable energy. There's enough wind west of the Mississippi to supply 3 times the amount of electricity America currently uses. Conservation, Americans waste 28% of the electricity they currently use. Solar power, there should be solar panels on every single building and house in America, so they're all independent from the grid. Wind power is enormous. Tidal power, geothermal energy is extraordinary. And that should be now been installed in all buildings across America. Instead of spending money on nuclear weapons and the Pentagon for killing, it should be used to save the planet. So I am as concerned about global warming, or more so than George Monbiot. I wrote a book about it in 2001 called If You Love This Planet, that's just been updated. Nuclear power itself produces large quantities of global warming gas because it must be fueled. And the fuel is uranium, and in Australia we have about 40% of the world's richest uranium, and it's dug up using huge amounts of fossil fuel. Then it has to be milled and crushed, more fossil fuel. Then it's enriched using a huge amount of fossil fuel. They've just closed Paducah enrichment plant in Kentucky, but that used 2,500 megawatt coal-fired plants to provide the electricity to enrich the uranium. And that's not even the lot. You know, then you have to build the reactor, which involves making concrete, and that's a very CO2-emitting process. And then you've got to store the radioactive waste for 1,000,000 years and transport it God knows where and build huge repositories, all with fossil fuels. So George Monbiot doesn't know what he's talking about. and he hasn't read the literature, and clearly he hasn't read my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, because in my first chapter I go through the amount of carbon dioxide and other global warming gases induced by nuclear power in its own right. What's more, most of the reactors in the world now are reaching the end of their lifespans, and it takes 10 to 15 years to build a new one, and there's no way that nuclear power can... Well, I mean, it produces CO2 anyway, so the argument that he used is valueless and fallacious. And then you don't even, you know, then we have to think about the radioactive waste and the inheritance for future generations.
Dr. Caldicott, when it comes to the threat of, I mean, if we had, maybe this is a little simplistic, but let's just say we had a continuum like where from 1 to 10, where we rank, you know, 10 is Armageddon and 1 is just sort of a weak concern. Where would you place climate change, and where would you place the nuclear threat?
Okay, there are three major threats threatening the planet now, all of which we can fix. I don't like to use the word climate change, the phrase, because that's the phrase that George Bush conjured up so people wouldn't be so scared. I use global warming. Global warming is a severe threat. The rate we're going now, it will probably be 6 degrees centigrade hotter by the end of this century, which is antithetical to life. Our children have no future. And there's no evidence that anyone wants to do anything about it. In fact, now that the Arctic ice is melting, they want to go and drill for oil up there and pour gasoline on the global warming fire. They're mad. We export coal in Australia like there's no tomorrow to China. China's building coal-fired plants left, right and centre. I can see no evidence that anyone, including the politicians who are pretty well controlled by the oil and gas and coal corporations and nuclear, doing anything about it. But we could. And I provided the answers with Arjun Makajani, or he did, in the book Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free. So, number one, we can fix global warming if we pull our fingers out and do what America did after Pearl Harbor. In 6 months, every single factory was converted to making weapons. Well, why isn't every single factory converted to making solar panels, windmills and the like? building solar panels. Now, nuclear war, we're in a very invidious situation at the moment with possibility of Russia and America confronting each other in Syria. Russia has over 1,000 hydrogen bombs on head trigger alert. You're all targeted. Every town with a population of 50,000 or more is targeted with at least one bomb. There may be 60 targeted on Washington alone or on New York. And America's got that many targeted on Russia, China, etc. Now, and those weapons are on hair trigger alert, they're ready to go with a press of a button by Putin or Obama, and they have 3 minutes to decide whether or not to press the button. Computer errors happen a lot in the early warning system. People are hacking into the early warning system if they could start a nuclear war. And especially as tensions rise in the Middle East, this is very, very dangerous.
Now, I think a lot of the concerns, I mean, because you were saying a lot of these same things back in the 1980s at the height of the Cold War, and I think that a lot of the concerns kind of waned after the fall of the Berlin Wall, but you obviously would argue that the threat has never gone away, at least not completely.
I wouldn't argue. I would say categorically the threat hasn't gone away. In fact, it's worse than during the Cold War, because the weapons are still there. Nothing's changed. Clinton didn't get rid of them. He could have worked with Yeltsin to have, you know, abolish nuclear weapons. Of the I don't know, 20,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97%. And they're still willing and able, if necessary, to blow up the planet and destroy all life on Earth. And with proliferation of nuclear weapons, you know, a war between India and Pakistan could trigger a global nuclear war between Russia and America. And that is simply being ignored. And the fact is that we can abolish nuclear weapons. We can, if we decide. And Obama wants to, but he said, I need your help, and people are sound asleep at the wheel. And the third risk, and we can fix global warming if we decide. We can fix the threat of nuclear war if we decide that we don't all want to die. And the third risk is nuclear power, which is not as cataclysmic as nuclear war, but as I said earlier, will induce epidemics of disease for the rest of time amongst humans and all animals and plants. Now, we could close down all the reactors, and that's kind of starting to happen, but then we're saddled with radioactive waste.
Just to sort of reinforce the urgency, could you maybe relate or remind our listeners of close calls that we've seen in the past where we came close to an actual thermonuclear war?
Someone plugged a war games tape into the computers in the Pentagon, I think in 1995, and by mistake. And the Pentagon thought it was for real. And they got to within just a few minutes of launching the missiles. The early warning system has been set off in the past by a flock of geese, because the satellites picked up the light from the geese and thought it was the light reflected from the missiles coming across to America. It's been set off by a rising moon. During 9/11, the Pentagon went to the highest stage of nuclear alert from DEFCON 5, 4, 3, 2. And 1 is when you press the button, simply because no one knew what was happening, no one knew who attacked the trade towers, and so the system is automatically set up, so if that sort of situation arises, then you automatically go to the highest stage of nuclear alert when you then launch your missiles. There are so many of those close calls. I knew Bob McNamara, who was in the Oval Office with Jack Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he said to me, and his face was white, he said, Helen, you don't know how close we came within minutes, of a nuclear war. I don't actually know how we're still here, and when I wrote The New Nuclear Danger, I collected all the evidence, as one does with the patient, and I really couldn't really understand how it is that we're still here. And we're still under that same threat, only it's getting worse.
Was there not also an incident where President Boris Yeltsin had his suitcase activated and he had just a few minutes to decide?
Yes, what happened was America launched a weather satellite from Norway, and the Russians picked it up and thought that America had launched a nuclear war. And, yes, Boris Yeltsin did get out his suitcase. He was sitting in, it's called the football, but it's a suitcase with the nuclear codes. And he had his general standing over his shoulder saying, Mr. President, press that button. And at the very, very last minute, the missile veered off course. And that's why you and I are talking over the phone and why we're still here.
Looking at the political situation, you of course did your best to impress on President Reagan way back in the day at the height of the Cold War about the dangers of nuclear weapons, and you were just talking about Obama. How would you prepare? Do you feel any more confident that this current president is gets it, and that can take some sort of initiative that will?
Well, I think he's much more cautious and more sensible and more highly intelligent than Reagan, who I met. I think under his watch, there's no way that he would initiate a nuclear war unless, you know, all the sort of systems said go, launch. And it's all under computer control. And he gets 3 minutes to make a decision whether or not to blow up the planet. So it's not really within his purview to decide when push comes to shove.
Helen Caldicott, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Well, I hope that the messages that you bring forward will somehow penetrate the consciousness of our leadership and the wider public. So thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Thank you, Michael, and so do I.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across the country. We're also podcast at globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. The website globalresearch.ca has put together a number of articles on the nuclear threat. In addition to an interactive reader on Fukushima, there is the prospect of a tactical nuclear weapons being used under a new post-9/11 nuclear doctrine. To tell us more, we have with us Michel Chossadovsky on the line from Montreal. He is the Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, author of The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, and his most recent book is entitled Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War. Thank you for joining us, Michel Chossadovsky. Could you tell us more about this post-9/11 nuclear doctrine?
During the Cold War era, you had the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, which was called MAD, namely that you understood, at least people understood, that the use of nuclear weapons would result in the destruction of both the attacker and the defender. And what has happened in the post-Cold War era, but particularly in the post-9/11 era, is that the nuclear doctrine has been totally revamped. And I'm referring to a document, it's a very important document, which is called the Pentagon's 2001 Nuclear Posture Review. And this document actually envisages the use of so-called tactical nuclear weapons on a first strike use, not only against so-called axis of evil countries, including Iran and North Korea, but also against Russia and China. And what is at stake is the formulation of a preemptive nuclear war doctrine. It implies the development of new weapon systems, the billions and billions of dollars which have been allocated to nuclear weapons. And at the same time, they're now placing the emphasis on what are called mini-nukes or tactical nuclear weapons, which are smaller nuclear bombs, but nonetheless with an explosive capacity, a yield varying between one-third and six times the Hiroshima bomb. But what the Pentagon is saying is that these tactical nuclear weapons, which would be delivered with a bunker buster earth penetrator weapon system, are harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground. This is pure propaganda. What they have done is that they've changed the labels on the bomb in the same way as you would change the label on a cigarette pack and say smoking is good for your health. Mm-hmm. Now, another dimension, which is not well understood, is that nuclear war and nuclear doctrine have, in a sense, been privatized. Let me explain. Shortly after 9/11, 2 years after 9/11, August 6, 2003, which is Hiroshima Day. That particular day was chosen, August 6, 2003, to hold a secret meeting behind closed doors at Strategic Command Headquarters at the Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. And senior execs from the nuclear industry, I'm talking about the private sector, the meeting was intended to set the stage for the development of a new generation of smaller, safer, more usable nuclear weapons. As I mentioned, those are the mini-nukes, and these were to be used in theater alongside conventional weapons. And in essence, what has happened is that the dividing line between a conventional weapon and a nuclear weapon has been blurred, And now the mini nukes can be used in the conventional war theater. They're part of what they call the military toolbox, the weapons tools box, and the decision to use them can be taken by a three-star general in the war theater within the system of geographic commands without necessarily having the clearance of the President of the United States.
It seems like what you're saying then is that up until August 6, 2003, nuclear weapons were essentially a bluff. If you attack us, we can hit you hard. But in this instance, you're talking about it actually becoming a normal, just another weapon that can be used in a conventional war, except that it would be nuclear. Looking at since I know your website has been monitoring the situation right now with Syria, Iran, the Asia pivot, how do you see this new nuclear doctrine with this new generation of weapons realistically being applied?
Well, first let me say that I think that the preemptive nuclear doctrine predates 9/11. When they first started developing the so-called B-61-11, which is a tactical nuclear weapon, it's a bunker buster bomb but with a nuclear warhead, the first country which was a candidate for its use was Libya during the Clinton administration. And they were going to use it to destroy an alleged weapons of mass destruction facility. And it was made public by the Pentagon, but ultimately that project was then shelved, and there's no indication that it was actually used in Libya. But these tactical nuclear weapons are fully deployed. In fact, they're deployed in several European countries, which are non-nuclear states. Belgium, Holland, Italy, Germany, Turkey have U.S.-made tactical nuclear weapons which are deployed, ready for use, and they're targeted at the Middle East. This is known and documented. And nonetheless, these countries are categorized as non-nuclear states, even though they have a weapons arsenal, which is made in America. In the context, let's say, of the war in the Middle East, the United States and its allies are indeed contemplating the use of nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, against Iran. This is an extremely dangerous situation because, from a decision-making point of view, it could get easily out of hand, and there's no consultative mechanism as during the Cold War era, you know, where you had a hotline between the Kremlin and the White House. You don't have that anymore. And the possibility for errors taking place and for a commander in the war theater, e.g., you know, in the Middle East, based in Doha and in Qatar, would possibly consider using tactical nuclear weapons, which are deployed and which are under various command structures.
And that was Michel Chossudovsky, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and author of the recent book, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.